You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 12th of January 2018 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Emma Nelson, and coming up on today's programme, the CDU and Social Democrats take the first step to forming a coalition in Germany. So they have a government, right? Wrong. We'll look at the long and winding road to political stability. My guests, Andrew Tuck, Henry Rees-Sheridan and Matt Alagaya, will be keeping it Monocle today as they discuss this and the day's other top stories, including the design for Milan's Bosco Verticale is exported around the world. We'll ask if it's the answer to our city's housing and pollution woes. We'll create a to-do list for the UK's new Foreign Office interior designers. Plus, step behind the curtain, please, and breathe in.
I think I could lose a little weight. I've always been a little bit this way, you know? I've sort of always been that.
Donald Trump has his annual health check. We'll take a look at our own working habits and see if we're as tremendous as him. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. So welcome to Midori House. This Friday, my guests in the studio are Andrew Tuck, Matt Alagaya and Henry Rees-Sheridan. One of those gentlemen is keeping it dry this January. The others, we'll see. There's been a breakthrough, let us begin with Germany, in the new agonisingly long process of forming a government. Angela Merkel's CDU party and the Social Democrats, led by Martin Schulz, have agreed to move on to formal coalition talks. We have realised the world isn't waiting for us, said Frau Merkel at a news conference. Well, Matt, let's begin with you. It is a good job that the world hasn't been waiting for Germany to get its act together, because they've taken an awfully long time. They've made a bit of a fist of it, and we're still a long way to go, aren't we?
Absolutely. I mean, this is the longest time, for about 45 years, it's the longest this paralysis has happened, sort of working out a coalition. And it has been a long time. I mean, the election was in September. But I guess you have to realise that, you know, it was a kind of unprecedented election. Both the SPD and Merkel's party, the CDU, they had their lowest election results for about 45 years. So it does make you think, you know, this was unprecedented, and German politics has been kind of fragmented in a way, which we haven't seen before. So it was going to take this long. But it is good news. I guess the one slightly thing to be a bit careful about is the fact that we kind of should hold our horses here, because the SPD, the rank and file, still need to vote on this. And they have a party conference in Bonn on January the 21st. And they have a lot of reasons to vote against this agreement, actually.
A lot of them had been quite cross in the past, hadn't they, that in previous coalitions, any ideas that they had come up with, Angela Merkel would often credit as her own idea.
Absolutely. I mean, this is the problem with being a junior partner in a coalition, really. You know, we saw it with the Liberal Democrats here in 2010, that if you go into leadership with a bigger party, they take credit for all your good ideas, and they don't, you know, and you get dumped with the blame if anything goes wrong. And I think there's a problem with identity here as well. I mean, the SPD has lost its identity in past grand coalitions of this ilk. And I think they need to be worried about that again here, because you don't want to get lumped in with all the mainstream parties, particularly when you see the AfD, which is, you know, the far right party. They would love it to kind of falter, because then it shows that all of the mainstream parties are basically one and the same. And the SPD needs to be careful that doesn't happen.
Andrew, and the way that this has been played out, it's taking an awful long time. And in many other situations, I'm trying to imagine, you know, taking 6 or 7 months in the United Kingdom or in France or in the United States for someone to come up with the beginnings of a coalition agreement. No one seems to have been that panicked, have they? A little bit. I think it gave everybody the heebie-jeebies. But as Angela Merkel said, everyone stopped really worrying about Germany. They said, "Oh, you can carry on. You can get on with it, and we'll just carry on as we're going."
Yeah, I guess there's the domestic story where actually people weren't panicked. I think they felt that things would be good. But on the broader stage, you know, while we have Brexit going on, I think certainly within London there were concerns that actually, whatever way it fell, that they needed to have a good partner to talk to. And also, I think for the French, you know, here we have, you know, Emmanuel Macron, who's come out the gates fighting for Europe, determined to make his case, and he needed the Germans alongside to kind of reignite the European tale. And what's interesting is all the signatures to this, all the potential partners have said, actually, one of the things we need to do is focus on the relationship between Berlin and Paris. We need to be much more proactive about supporting the European Union. And there is money put aside to help do that. But it is also interesting. I read through the details of how they finally, after all this curry first, managed to kind of get themselves together. And there's some really dull things they've agreed on. Health insurance was apparently one of the stickiest things, and they've managed to get their heads around that. And actually, some of the things we thought were going to be headline migration figures are in there, but didn't seem to be as much a crunch point as we think. So they're going to limit the number of family members who can come to existing refugee families. They're going to try and put a cap roughly 180,000 to 200,000 new migrants per year. But kind of all of that stuff was, it sounds like that was more easy over the curryverse than actually boring old health insurance.
It is. I mean, you were nodding enthusiastic at the prospect of Currywurst Henry Rees Sheridan. Would that be a clincher for you in sort of like perhaps reorganising, let's say, British domestic politics? Give them a Currywurst and off they go.
I was meditating on what you could extract out of me in terms of political promises by dangling a Currywurst in front of me. And conclusions in my... I mean, just kind of running a thought experiment in my head. Suffice it to say, I'm glad I'm not an elected official.
Right. Or indeed a member of the British Secret Services, because could you be bought easily for a currywurst?
Probably, right. To be honest with you, under the right circumstances. Coming back, though, if I may, to the this is a blueprint for a formal coalition talks to go ahead. As Matt mentioned, they still have to be voted on by the rank and file of the SPD. Looking at the coverage of this, I do wonder if news outlets have begun to conflate the political crisis in Germany with the broader challenges that the country faces. It's quite kind of euphoric, the tone of the coverage. They have managed to overcome an initial hurdle to forming a coalition in Parliament. This may or may not happen, but it doesn't change the fact that the AfD are still the third biggest party in that parliament. The only reason they're not being talked about is because they are not party to these coalition talks, because everyone else has agreed not to play with them. And it doesn't change that. The fact that this initial hurdle has fallen and been overcome doesn't change the fact that Germany is still facing a huge demographic crisis, a huge social crisis, which were precisely the forces that brought that party to power in the first place.
And at the helm, Matt, is a weakened Angela Merkel. She has been a caretaker chancellor for the last few months, which I think about a year ago many would consider inconceivable.
Absolutely. I mean, she's been one of the most respected and most experienced leaders, I guess, in Europe over the past 10 years now. And yeah, her position is very weak in her own country. And I mean, I guess this does give her a bit of breathing room. But, she's now in the pocket to the SPD and then the CSU, which is her part of the party that is down in Bavaria. And, she's being pulled in all directions because she didn't manage to get a majority herself.
And you mentioned, Andrew, the idea of France being a key figure in this. I think we've covered several times on Monocle 24 the idea of Emmanuel Macron's great vision for the reform of Europe being completely put on ice because of the problems in Germany's domestic issues. But now we have Martin Schulz in the Social Democrats. He is the former president of the European Parliament. He's a man who says that the creation of a United States of Europe should come about by 2025. Are we looking now at a Germany that, alongside France, will be in a position to lead major reform of the European Union?
I certainly think they'll be in a position to reimagine what Europe looks like. And that's we obviously focus on Brexit a great deal and what's the UK going to look like and this country going to look like. But actually, the interesting question is, what will Europe look like without the UK? They're having a kind of ruptious East, as it were. Many kind of, Orban in Hungary, all these countries where they're not so sure about the European project as well. And I think finally, between the two of them, they will be able to kind of come up with a new vision of what Europe should be. And I feel reasonably positive about that.
I think it's worth pointing out, too, that this blueprint was agreed to on the condition that Scholz's specific vision for a United States of Europe was put on ice. So it's a unifying vision for Europe, but it's not the one that he proposed.
No mention of currywurst in the coalition start, though. We'll get there one day. 10 past 6 here, 18:10 here on Monocle 24. It's time on Midori House to hug a high rise. It looks like Milan's Bosco Verticale has become a blueprint for solving our city's housing and pollution problems. The design for the rather lovely part tower block, part woodland, has been exported abroad. The Dutch city of Eindhoven is to get its version. Lausanne, Paris, Nanjing, Utrecht, they're all on the list to get one too. Andrew, is the Bosco Verticale the answer to all our prayers?
Well, first of all, I think that this building is interesting, but it shouldn't take all of the limelight, as it were. There's loads of people already doing really interesting things around this. If you go to Singapore, they already have a policy, which means that if you put up a new high-rise, the amount of green space that you create has to be greater than the footprint of the building by several times. So this means that when you go up many high-rises in Singapore, you'll suddenly find there's a kind of a floor that isn't there because they've had to put a garden in the middle. They definitely are using the top space. All kind of interesting, all looks pretty nice. You try and find a small bird that wants to fly up more than 6 floors, or a butterfly. So you go up about 50 metres is the peak that you'll find anything else alive. So it only works on the ground space. Again, looks pretty. Why do we need green space in our cities to cool them? It's good at that. But what we are lacking as we live in denser and denser places is space to feel a bit of grass beneath our feet, to, you know, run our hand across a tree. Now, if that's stuck up on someone's balcony or on a vertical garden, which is one of my bete noirs, I don't see the point of it. I think it kind of looks pretty. It's not the function of what green space does. We know that we need to be in green space. It does help you to look at it. And one last thing, again, it's amazing how this building, when you look for pictures, there are like a multitude of renders and CADs and fake imagery. And I was trying to find pictures taken from inside of people's actual balconies. And I began to find them. It turns out that you do need to water those plants and look after them rather carefully because, you know, maybe some of the big trees can hold on. There's quite a lot of people with really scrappy, ugly balconies and windswept plants because, again, only certain things can thrive above a certain level. So if they're going to export it, it's got to be plants that are very good at withstanding rain and wind in less temperate climates than Milan. And actually, I would just say, how do we make space that people can sit on and play on and, you know, wheel out their sick parents on and all sorts of things? That's the green space we ultimately need.
We don't have that, though, in so many places, Matt. I mean, if you look at London, those communal spaces where the lovely serendipity of life, where you can bump into someone and meet them and talk to another human being instead of retreating to your square box at night to get depressed, that seems to be more and more the problem, doesn't it? People have been building on green spaces. So, I don't know, obviously Andrew's not a fan, but to put a tree anywhere, frankly, is a tick in the box, isn't it?
I suppose so. I mean, I think, you know, we're fairly lucky in London. I think we have these amazing parks that were handed down to us by these big mansion houses that used to be in the middle of the country. And now they're, you know, they're suddenly parks and they have been protected over centuries. So I think we're relatively lucky. I think where it is difficult is in more, I guess, modern cities or cities that have grown very, very fast. And Singapore is a very good example. You know, they have such limited space there. It is a tiny island. And I mean, I agree with Andrew. I think there's absolutely no kind of way you can get around it. It's much better to have parks and green space on the ground. But I do think, you know, Singapore has tried its very best because it has such limited space. It's growing so fast and it does need the housing. You know, it's one of the densest cities in the world. And I think, you know, having balconies and having gardens on sort of high up floors is one way around it. But yeah, it's not enough on its own, for sure.
Do you often sometimes think, when I see things like the Bosco Verticale, which everybody knows about now because it's interesting to look at, it's a new idea and it makes everybody think about the way that they live. But if one city says, we're going to put up Bosco Verticale, do you sometimes fear, like I do, that they will say, well, that was my big gesture. We've spent a lot of money on one wonderful building and a lot of other things will go by the side?
Well, yeah, I think there's a tendency, I think, or it could be a symptom of a tendency to focus on quantity over quality. So, you know, we have X many square meters of green space in our city. It doesn't matter what direction it's going in, as long as we have it there. It turns into a little bit of a box-ticking exercise. I agree with Matt and Andrew that I prefer my green spaces horizontal, personally. I think the issue is, in free market societies, in capitalistic cities, ultimately, the reason why they are so far and few between is because, and so difficult to get there, if they're not there, to place there, or to cultivate, is because every square foot of park is a square foot where someone isn't spending money. And at the end of the day, if you don't have a body, be it governmental or private, aggressively acquiring, competing with property developers, and acquiring land to convert and sustain as parkland and recreational land, it isn't going to come about by itself. And I think that, you know, that is a reality that people who want these kinds of things in cities should face.
So who is getting it right, Andrew?
Well, just to dive in, though, what's interesting is, you know, I don't know, that good old capitalist rant, I'm not sure that makes much sense, really, because actually when I just went over the weekend to see what Argent are doing around King's Cross, a project we've followed, I've dived in to see, this is the redevelopment around the railway stations. You know, and again, it's, you know, many people question it because it is in fact private space, which is policed as such. But actually, the quality and quantity of planting and public seating that they've put in is elaborate and pretty incredible. Now, there's a developer who realises that public realm is actually a way of attracting people into a community, and that in these high-rise buildings, which have, you know, many of them have no balcony whatsoever, really just windows that open, and that's the way they get fresh air. They need to have space downstairs, and many of them have enclosed gardens as well. So I feel that there's often a private developer who is getting to understand the value of green space.
Don't get me wrong, I think that private bodies are perfectly capable of doing this, perhaps more capable than state bodies, but they have to want to do it. And the fact of the matter is, there are fewer at the moment, I think, who want to do it than who do want to do it.
And just one tiny last thing, you know, this, yeah, you know, I don't say that this, you know, this vertical forest is completely wrong, and yet it shades a few buildings, and you have a bit more of a cooler environment inside, so you can turn down the dial on the aircon. But the same as you, when people put up these green walls, somehow they're kind of championed as though that it's a piece of public realm, which is not. You know, they're full of plants which aren't from this, you know, from this country as well. That never change with the seasons. They might as well be plastic, because they, you know, they're kind of like so unwilling to kind of bend with the seasons. And there's nothing you can do with them. You can, you know, you look at them and they're kind of cool, but if you need somewhere to sit, they're not going to help you.
You're listening to Midori House, here with me, Emma Nelson, Andrew Tuck, Matt Allagaya and Henry Rees Sheridan, in a moment why the UK Foreign Office needs interior designers.
Our very own Monocle Library is growing into a robust collection of well-turned-out titles. For an in-depth look into our core theme of quality of life, why not delve into our first-ever book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living? For any would-be business leaders, entrepreneurs, or even established companies in search of fresh ideas, there's the Monocle Guide to Good Business. In How to Make a Nation, a Monocle Guide, we look at the small and the big things that can help make our nations work better. And in the Monocle Guide to Drinking and Dining, we bypass the foam and the fuss to uncover the makings of a truly great meal. Monocle's handsome books are published by our friends at Gestalten in Berlin and offer a world of new experiences between the covers. So spruce up your shelves today and buy some of our titles online at monocle.com or from any good bookstore.
Nearly 1819 here in London, 1919 if you're listening in Milan. You're with Midori House, and still joining me in Studio One are editor Andrew Tuck, Matt Allagaya and Henry Rees Sheridan. The UK has decided that while it drives a cart and horses through the traditional geopolitical landscape, it shall do so in a nicely furnished room. An advert for not one, but two interior designers has been posted to work at the Foreign Office. They'll have to, according to the job spec, have full understanding of traditional and contemporary furnishing techniques. International travel will be expected. Andrew, this is soft furnishing power.
Oh, look at you, that's clever. I agree. Now, the interesting thing is, what is the relationship normally between, you know, somebody who's asking for a piece of work to be done and their, you know, their interior designer or their architect, or if they have one, if they're lucky enough to have one? Now, it's actually a relationship where you need a bit of kind of push and shove. And my fear is that two junior interior designers being brought into the Foreign Office and sitting underneath all the mandarins being told what to do will end up doing what they're being told to do, and we'll end up with some rather hideous buildings. Let's see. Let's hope it works out better than that. But the role of an interior designer in the embassy, you know, in our consulates around the world, I think is really, really important. Here's an amazing way by choosing not just, you know, a hoard from the antique pile, but from using contemporary designers, whether that's people making plates and cutlery or whether it's people making furniture, that we can champion British craft and design. And that's what other embassies do. So if you go to any Danish embassy, for example, they seem to have managed to hit the right note between the classic and the new, and between everything from photography and art. Now, again, we're pretty good at sending out the art, but actually, on the when it comes down to the furniture, it tends to be stuff that's been there either a million years or it's come from some central store and is not very nice.
It is a bit of a challenge, isn't it? I mean, for the chief designer is going to get £38,000 a year plus a little bit of London waiting, just so that they can, well, I don't know, commute in from Milton Keynes. But they have got this issue, haven't they? Because they have huge ambition, they have huge heritage, but they're going to be based in Whitehall. Chances are they're going to head to John Lewis in their lunchtime, and every embassy is going to look like my mother-in-law's.
Oh, God. I mean, that is the kind of
nightmare.
We don't
know what her mother-in-law's looks like. It might be fabulous.
That's true, yeah. Who is she?
She likes beige.
Okay. I mean, that's the thing. I think, no doubt there will be people out there criticising this and saying it's a waste of money. But I think, yeah, if it's done well, it could be fantastic. And as Andrew said, if it was the Danish or the Swedes doing this, we'd be kind of fawning over them and saying how amazing it is.
Just on this point of it being a waste of money too, I didn't expect to get as wound up as I got about this. But I think, so there's this quote by John O'Connell, who's the chief executive of the Taxpayers Alliance, which is kind of a taxpayers watchdog in Britain, at the bottom of this article in the Times, saying, you know, he wonders why the Foreign Office was attaching importance to interior design at a time when savings need to be made across Whitehall. I think that's such a facile point. And I think that, you know, if someone's got to do the interior design for these buildings, someone has to. Now, they could hire in a freelancer, and perhaps, you know, Andrew, your concerns about aesthetics would be met better by hiring a big name interior designer in that regard. But in terms of it being a waste of money, you know, both of my parents work in the public sector in Swansea Civic Centre, which, suffice it to say, is not a Danish embassy in terms of interior design. And the problem is, it's so easy to object to any spending on things which are categorised in the collective psyche as unnecessary in the public sector that they get totally neglected, and it's impossible to take any positive action in that regard at all.
Yeah, but nincompoops like this, they have no appreciation of, you know, beauty or the value of design. And we're not just talking about, you know, first of all, there is an aesthetic thing. If you walk into a building that looks and feels great, your attitude changes. Now, we're talking about people coming in. We need people to do deals. We need people to be a bit impressed about what brand Britain is.
We really need people to be impressed.
And if you come into an environment, you think, do you know this? This is kind of cool, you know, and I don't mean like, you know, blooming Union Jack scatter cushions. I'm talking about that someone has taken serious decisions about representing Britain in the interior design, in all those things. And also, the boring thing that, you know, idiots like that forget is that behind all of these things are huge industries, you know. So you pick up a plate, that's about the revival of the potteries, and that's about, you know, a whole Stoke-on-Trent. What's the future of this deprived town? That's the difference it makes by using interior design well.
So where are you going to headhunt this £38,000 a year bright interior design spark who knows their way around some of the United Kingdom's most dazzling historic properties, but will be able to say, actually, that Emma Bridgewater teapot, that's a great symbol of of British design.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, on the whole, if you're sitting in the, you know, the embassy in Paris or the, you know, the embassy in Rome, I don't think you probably will need the services of these people. They've pretty much got it sorted. But when we're talking about opening new outposts or where we're revamping places in economies where we haven't paid much attention to, then I think that's where we should bring in a consultant rather than actually having someone sitting within the Foreign Office.
Okay. Donald Trump had his health check today. Recent reports suggest his mental health might not be as robust as one would like. But now, three men, a White House physician, a Navy doctor and a Rear Admiral, make of that final task what you will, have been given the job of evaluating the physical health of the leader of the free world. Matt Alagaya, does Donald Trump look like a healthy specimen to you?
No, he doesn't. And what's really funny is that he didn't look particularly healthy during the campaign as well. And I found an amazing quote, which I'd actually forgotten, but he published. There were sort of worries about his health during the presidential campaign. And Trump actually found his doctor and asked him for to send a statement out. And this doctor said, "If elected, Mr. Trump, I can state unequivocally, will be the healthiest individual ever elected to the presidency." And I mean, that's kind of completely ludicrous because obviously he wasn't. He looked really unhealthy and he probably was as well. He was also the oldest man to be elected president. The trouble is, so he's having this health check and he doesn't have to publish it. I mean, I think this is one of the norms that Obama did as well. He published it, but his was kind of a glowing record saying that he's 6'3" and he's really healthy and he plays sport every day. Trump may not. I mean, he doesn't really respect norms normally. You know, he hasn't published his tax returns, so I'm not sure he will end up publishing this, unfortunately.
So it is this interesting thing, isn't it, that we have a public picture of this man, don't we? And there's this wonderful thing about his presidential dinner. He's usually two Big Macs, two fillet of fish, and a chocolate malted. He likes a burger. What sort of soft power image does it give to the rest of the world, Henry Rees Sheridan, that, well, we all know what it does for Donald Trump, but if he publishes a glowing report of his health, he only needs to tell us what he has, well, we have to take him a little bit more seriously, if his heart is in wonderful check, his blood vessels are perfect.
So the question is, what soft power image is sent if
he comes
a man
out saying,
who openly consumes McDonald's every single day comes back with a clean bill of health?
But he's in absolute peak fitness.
I'm not sure if it specifically sends a soft power image.
Probably just changes the order. I'll have fries with that as well.
Precisely, yeah. No, I want to raise Matt's quote.
Okay.
Because I'm sure we all came across some good ones while we were researching this one. Now, this isn't a quote. Well, I think it's a paraphrase of Trump, but it comes from an Evan Osnos article in The New Yorker last year about some of Trump's habits. It was one of the most extraordinary sentences I've read in quite a while. Apparently, Trump considers exercise misguided, arguing that a person, like a battery, is born with a finite amount of energy, which is...
There's nothing really
left
to disagree
me speechless.
With that.
But that's almost verging into religious mysticism, isn't it? Kind of beyond just kind of run of the mill views on health.
Andrew, what would you require staff to pass if you had to do a Okay, so you're sitting on the editorial floor and you're striding up and down. And you're deciding, you just think, well, you know, that Matt Alagaya seems like he had a couple of extra mince pies over Christmas. What are you going to do to him?
Well, we do have a culture editor who once said to me, actually, not that long ago, "Running, aren't you meant to have stopped doing that by the time you were 7? And I think that is his view. And oddly, he looks rather fitter than me annoyingly. But anyway, I don't know within the work environment. So the difference here is we do have somebody who has the nuclear codes and has the ability to kind of, you know, set off a global war. So if he's got mental health issues, I think those things we do need to know about. But it's interesting how, you know, the very nature of politics is by the time you get to the top of the game, you're not a young man normally or young woman. So, you know, I was just looking at Theresa May has obviously had to tell us that she's got diabetes. Mitterrand had severe prostate cancer all of his last years in office. JFK was battling Addison's disease. Ronald Reagan had the first signs of Alzheimer's. Wilson here in the UK had colon cancer. Churchill, bless him, had a stroke and couldn't move one side of his body and was holding cabinet meetings in his bed. Now, he kind of somehow managed to muster through in his final term after the war. So all of these people, it's like they're at the ends of their... Not Theresa May, bless her. But many of these older guys were getting on in the day. So it's not surprising they had something wrong. Now, if we had known that, maybe our minds would have been changed. I don't know.
Okay. Thank you for that. Bless Theresa May. That brings us to the end of today's show. My thanks to Andrew Tuck, Matt Allegar and Henry Rhys Sheridan. My thanks to our producer too, Marcus Hippie, our researcher Fernanda Augusta Pacheco and Leah Fournier, and our studio manager Christy Evans. More music is next, and then at 1900 it's The Menu with Marcus Hippie, and we'll have more on the day's top stories on The Monocle Daily at 2200. Midori House is back at the same time on Monday. For now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.